welcome to the Theology Mill podcast brought to you by Wipfenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickle, and I am on staff here at Wipfenstock, and I'm also the host of this podcast, which consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. If you like what you're hearing on this podcast, please come stop by our website at wipfenstock.com, where you can browse our catalog and also check out our blog. So in this Luminaries interview, I speak with Professor John Milbank. Professor Milbank is the Emeritus Professor of Politics, Religion, and Ethics at the University of Nottingham, where he is also President of the Center of Theology and Philosophy. He's the author of the very well-known book Theology and Social Theory Beyond Secular Reason, and his most recent book, which is written with Adrian Pabst, is The Politics of Virtue, Post-Liberalism and the Human Future. So with that, thank you very much for listening, and we hope you enjoy this conversation. Okay, so I am very honored to be here today with Professor John Milbank, Professor Emeritus at University of Nottingham and author of a handful of books, probably most famously Theology and Social Theory. Professor Milbank is a founding figure of a movement called Radical Orthodoxy. So as we get started, Professor Milbank, thank you very much for joining the Theology Mill. Could you maybe lead us off by just telling us a bit about yourself, perhaps where you're from, what areas of inquiry your research involves, and so forth?
Well, I'm 70 years old, and I was born just north of London, and I've lived in lots of different parts of England. 36 years north of the River Trent and 34 years south. And the Trent is a bit like the Mason-Dixon line in England, if you like.
I see.
And but the other way around. And I'm half Scottish, half English, a little bit Irish. And I know most of the British Isles pretty well. And very attached to France and Italy as well. I've lived in Virginia for about nearly 7 years. I'm pretty rooted in Britain, but I have other attachments as well. How would I describe what I do? It's quite difficult, I suppose, because I've got very dispersed interests, but I would say that I'm both a philosopher and a theologian, and I'm also very interested in history. And ultimately, I don't see those three things as distinguished from each other. If I can put it that way, I think we need an approach today that brings all three together, which in some ways I think means returning to the 19th century almost, picking up on where people like Hegel and Schelling and Ravasson left off, if you like, and maybe leaving a lot of the 20th century on the shelf. It turns out not to be as important, perhaps, as people imagine. What am I doing at the moment is trying to develop a book about metaphysics that will be very much what I've said. You know, it'll be simultaneously a work of theology and of philosophy, and to some degree also a work of history of religions, central to that. I mean, that kind of mix, I suppose, has been with me ever since I wrote my doctoral thesis on Jean-Baptiste Vico. But I think it's got even stronger, if you like, more recently. What the current book will be very much a metaphysics of creativity, or rather a metaphysics in which creativity is the absolutely central principle. I mean, creativity and generosity. So the book will be called Gift, Truth, and Reality. So that's what I'm doing at the moment. I've always been very critical of a theology that is, I think, just trying to fit in with secular narratives. And I think I'm going sort of even further now in that kind of direction to produce a basically theological account of reality as the only account that can really make sense. And increasingly, Schelling is very central for that, and the Russian, the sociologists are essentially ultimately rooted in Schelling and German Romanticism, and then also the French spiritualists, who via Ravissant are partly rooted in Schelling legacy as well. And a lot of the names that are now important for me are not the normal names that theologians work with any longer.
Sure. Thank you for that. Yeah, no, I think, I know many, a great many people will be very interested to read this forthcoming book on metaphysics you're talking about. One question that we like to open with on the podcast, which is kind of a fun one, is if you could place any three people, so any three people dead or alive, around a table, and you could kind of listen to their conversation, which three figures would you choose and why?
Very difficult, because I can think of people from different eras. I mean, in the past, it would probably be kind of Maximus the Confessor, John Scotus of Rugena, and Nicholas of Cusa. If you're talking in more recent times, probably Schelling, Ravissant, and Soloviev.
What would you be probably most interested in hearing those figures talk about, the latter grouping you named?
I'd be interested in hearing them elaborate the extent to which they understand their work as a work of Christian theology. If they see it as mainly philosophical, why is that? What, if any, are the borderlines between philosophy and theology? And then I guess if they were suddenly revived nowadays, I'd want to ask them how they think their ideas, particularly about the philosophy of nature, how they would stand up in the face of contemporary science and the contemporary crisis of nature.
Sure. Okay. Would you say that what you're trying to do in terms of considering the kind of the boundaries between philosophy and theology, as you spoke to already, would you say that there's any kind of resemblance between what you're doing and what maybe some of these French phenomenological figures of the theological turn are doing? So people like Falk and Lacoste, especially, who are I think trying to kind of make porous again that boundary. Would you say there's any resemblance, but also is there anything distinct about what you're doing versus kind of what they're trying to do?
Yeah, I think there are both resemblances and differences. I think in the case of Immanuel Falk, there's quite a lot of similarity, because I think he's been increasingly critical of a sharp boundary between philosophy and theology. And, well, the same would apply to Jean-Yves Lacoste, and both of them probably allowing more porosity. But in the case of Marion, but the crucial difference would be that I would be returning to metaphysics. So I would be critical of the idea that phenomenology is the whole of philosophy. I mean, I would allow that there is an important phenomenological moment, but I would deny that from phenomenology you can get to any kind of serious realism. That, you know, the danger that phenomenology sort of resolves either into an agnostic skepticism or back into an idealism, an implausible idealism, I think is there. So that I don't think you can avoid the speculative moment that is involved in a realist metaphysics. So if you like, I think it's the non-primacy of phenomenology over hermeneutics that always tips you into taking some kind of metaphysical wager, if you like. And I don't think that that's aridly speculative, because I think it's involved with a kind of experience, you know, a kind of experience and a kind of feeling and a response of the heart, if you like. But I don't think that can be reduced to phenomenology, because phenomenology is always haunted by sort of the Cartesian notion of the clear and the distinct. Maybe you could even go further and say there's a sort of ambiguity in the Cartesian legacy, that if you take the clear and the distinct to be what you can reduce back to, you know, it's somehow absolutely and ineluctably given, so that you can't reduce any further. You know, even if you're reducing it to the terms of the gift in Levinas or Marion's sense, to me, that is still a very rationalist enterprise. It's a way of being sort of, as it were, rationalistic about the apparently non-rationalistic sounding, if you like to look at it that way. But then sort of the other way to look at the Cartesian legacy, especially as it was taken by Pascal and then the way it's read by Ravisson, is to say that the clear is the intuitive, it's the kind of overwhelmingly apparent, if you like, but not necessarily anything you can reduce. I know that Marion, for example, certainly talks about, you know, the infinite in Descartes in that way, but I still think he then reduces it to a kind of blank sublimity, if you like. He makes it something, the way he talks about saturation makes it something somehow too blank, instead of the idea that we're always dealing with a kind of mediation between the infinite and the finite, something analogical. And, you know, you can see the whole of Marion's thought as a kind of one long strange evasion of analogy, if you like to put it that way. So that what we're talking about is a kind of simultaneous phenomenology, but also metaphysics of the middle, of mediation. So this is the kind of thing that Emmanuel Gabellieri in Lyon is talking about, and the same kind of thing that Andrea Bellantoni is talking about in Toulouse. So to my mind, this is the coming thing in Catholic thought. And I would see the theological turn in phenomenology is already in some way old hat, that it's being displaced by the revival of spiritual realism and the realization that thinkers like Bergson and Blondel and Simone Weil are saying very similar things in the way that they all have this metaphysics of the metaxu, of a mediation. And when you go down that line, you you start to really develop, well, a metaphysics of love, a metaphysics of generosity, a metaphysics that is also a Trinitarian ontology, because everything starts to be about the idea that God goes out of himself and returns to himself, both within himself and in creation, and in incarnation. So that there's this sort of kenotic bending down and return that is this sort of discovery of oneself outside oneself that is the ultimate metaphysical principle, and that is going on through the whole of reality. This is the kind of thing that Ravesson was already saying, that you see this in nature, in natural growth. You see this in art. It's kind of the one becoming many and then recouping the many into unity. And if one thinks in the way that Schelling and Ravesson do, if one thinks of fallenness as sort of the escape of the many, or if you like, the escape in the created world of the filial principle, then what one comes to understand is that even though the fall is a kind of descent into seeing the material world as primary, which is also a narcissistic descent in which you see the ego as primary, then that's always defeated by the fact that God has descended even further than the descent that is evil. In other words, God has already gone down lower into matter through suffering, and this is the redemptive moment. So the incarnation is at once then an event, but it's also an apocalyptic revelation. It's a revelation that there's always been an incarnation, if you like. And this is much more now the way I would read the New Testament. I think it's the way it demands to be read. And so that evil is defeated because it turns out that God is also the creation, or at the heart of creation, it's identical with God, even though it's also distinct from God, if you like. So that the apocalyptic mystery, the genuinely Christian Gnostic mystery, if you like, is, you know, the identity of God with his creation, the hieros gamos, the sacral marriage, you know, the marriage between the male God, if you like, and the female emanation that is both God himself as his essence, and yet also the world, and that is then Mary and the church, and so forth. And that you can see this, as Ravesson already argues, you can see this as a mystery anticipated in paganism, in Greek myth, in Hinduism. But as Ravesson equally insists, then the problem always with paganism is this kind of overstress on necessity, that sort of traps us back in nature. So the argument, which he's obviously deriving from Schelling, is that all of kind of antique philosophy and antique metaphysics is too much caught within necessity. So it's too much focused on being a natural law as a kind of necessary given structure that reason just thinks about. Whereas the witness of the Bible is the witness that prior to necessity is a kind of contingency, even that God is in a funny kind of way contingent, in that he's not just there, he's not necessitated, he is also freedom. But this isn't to give way to a kind of voluntarism, it's much more to overcome the contrast between freedom and necessity. So, and that's of course why in Schelling the idea of art is so central, that it's in art that we see a free work, and yet somehow, you know, the Mona Lisa has to be the way the Mona Lisa is, you know, King Lear has to be the way King Lear is. Beethoven's Fifth Symphony has to be the way that symphony is, and so on. And then you see that as kind of the ultimate principle of reality. And then this is kind of the reversal that Schelling accomplishes. He says that then you have to have a higher empiricism. You have to say that philosophy is thinking the contingency of reality after reality. So it's just thinking in the way of given nature and given history, which is a work of freedom. It's a work of divine artistry. This is also why Ravasson says that nature is a matter. There aren't any natural laws. There are only habits in nature that look like laws, because nature itself is a creative work. And because we live in the creation, everything within the creation creates itself. Because if creation only consists of the divine creativity, then it is of itself creative. And I think this is the principle that kind of Arugula starts to see, that Nicholas of Cusa takes much further. It's also there in Vico. And then we're finding it also in Bergson, Blondel, Simone Weil as well, Louis Lavelle, who is an incredibly great thinker, that it's this idea that everything consists in creativity. And by the way, from this perspective, Heidegger is also total passé, because Heidegger is caught in this illusion that being is somehow hypostasized, and we're looking at being, and it's all necessitated. And Heidegger, Aristotle's metaphysics should have been about being, but somehow God gets in the way. No. Ravasson and Bergson read it exactly the opposite way around. And scholarship is now confirming the way they read it, that really everything in Aristotle's metaphysics points towards God, towards not to kind of being in the abstract, but being in the French sense of the word étant rather than the French word être, étant as a kind of living being, as first act, and so on. And of course, at that point, Thomas can resonate, I think, with with what I'm saying. But much more than Thomism, I would be wanting to say that there's not just energeia in God, the act. There's also a kind of higher kinesis, and this is something you already get with Plotinus, and is reflected a little bit in Maximus as well. This, the idea that God is beyond the contrast of rest and motion, so that there is a way in which God is bringing himself about. Marron and Heidegger are also completely wrong about the causa sui. And you should embrace that, and you should sort of fit it with the Trinity, and so forth. That you can then see rationally as well as by revelation exactly why God is Trinitarian. And this is where Thomas will protest. But honestly, before the 13th century, you can find lots of examples of theologians just not distinguishing between sort of rational and revealed approaches to the Trinity. And I think the distinction is very much artificial. So I think what I'm doing now is retrieving what I call a kind of radicalized orthodoxy that's rooted in Maximus and Arugula and Nicholas of Cusa, that's very much in continuity with the Renaissance and with Romanticism. So probably more than my previous work, I'm showing there's another way to be modern. This book, nobody will be able to say after this book that I'm wanting to return to the Middle Ages or something like that. It was already a ridiculous reading of what I've been trying to do. But after this book, people will probably make the opposite accusations, that I'm a modern heretic or something like that.
Sure. Okay, yeah, since we've brought up radical orthodoxy, I'd like to turn towards specifically kind of the origins of this movement. So how would you describe from your perspective the development of radical orthodoxy? How did this take place kind of both on the level of your own thinking, but also among kind of the community of scholars who have affiliated with this movement in various kinds of ways?
Well, you know, I'm not sure how good my memory is. And sometimes, you know, arguments seem very big at the time that don't seem so big in retrospect. But I would say, roughly speaking, it was born out of a sense of frustration amongst some younger academics and graduate students when I was in Cambridge. A feeling that even the people trying to resist a dominant sort of theological liberalism weren't quite going far enough. And already in theology and social theory, obviously, I sort of protested against secularity setting the agenda. So broadly speaking, radical orthodoxy was an attempt to say, look, we need to read the whole of reality in Christian terms, you know. So, and that's a perspective that I think I'm now taking even further. I think there were other elements going on as well. I think dissatisfaction with the kind of divisions within theology into different subject areas, the way so few people in theology seem to be actually doing theology, you know, that dissatisfaction with the division between theology and philosophy as well. And just, I suppose, a fundamental sense that it was all rather boring and unchallenging, and people were kind of retreating into very, very safe areas, particularly by saying, well, you know, Christianity is just a particular tradition following its own grammar and its own grammatical rules and this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I suppose already we wanted to return to a more full-blooded metaphysical approach. And looking back on things, I think at the time we were still, you know, quite influenced by the idea that sort of religious feeling and experience is all a bit too liberal. And nowadays, I'm not sure I think that at all any longer. You know, I think that religious feeling and experience is absolutely central. There's nothing particularly essentially liberal about it. I think that's just, you know, a survival of a kind of uninteresting debate between Barthians and Schleiermacherians, you know, and there are just misunderstandings all around and on both sides, and it's just not interesting. I think, you know, another factor as well was the impact of postmodernism. In fact, that was a very big factor at the time. And the feeling that theology hadn't sort of absorbed what was then understood as a critique of humanism, the idea that, you know, the death of man follows on the death of God. So a feeling that a lot of theology is still attached to a kind of residual humanism, and are trying to sort of creep up from humanism back to God, whereas we were wanting to say, well, you know, you can only have, you can only get humanity back if you restore God. And then very much sort of conjoined to that, there's responding to the postmodern argument that everything is sign and interpretation and uncertainty and unlimited semiosis and so forth, by suggesting that the answer to that is not to appeal to foundationalism or to hardcore truth, you know, not this kind of, you know, some of our colleagues went in for a lot of harumphing, you know, Again, skepticism. Whereas we would have been more inclined to point out, well, look, Augustine builds on skepticism and makes a Platonic response to skepticism. And we felt that that Platonic response was what you needed to repeat. You know, there isn't any imminent security, but we can understand our unending interpretive processes, the kind of the way we're totally in the middle, as Pascal put it. You know, we're not at the beginning or at the end, we're in the middle of uncertainty. But you can understand that as a participation in the eternal and the infinite, and that we're kind of groping towards in an uneasy way. So, you know, as Ravisson says, the indefinite is frightening, but infinity is a kind of security. if you have that sense that we can trust the infinite, we're suspended from the infinite, we participate in it. So obviously, from beginning to end, participation is very central in radical orthodoxy. And I think, you know, that has multiple dimensions. I think it's about mediation in the way I'm already talking about. And I think it's allied to a sense that you need a participatory and mediating social philosophy as well, that we're all members of one another. So it has... it also has political implications. And I suppose in my own case, I've always had the idea, I think participation and mediation are also about harmony, and this idea that, you know, one's refusing the ultimate sea of conflict. You know, the ultimacy of uncertainty is very close to the ultimacy of conflict. And part of my argument has always been that somehow modern liberalism and epistemology are linked to a kind of primacy of conflict that is challenged by Christianity, and that, you know, paganism as well, because it can't quite resolve where matter fits in, and it tends to associate evil with matter. Again, there's some sort of conflictual principle. Whereas if everything proceeds from love and generosity, then there's this kind of original peace. And the question of participation is an attempt to share in that. And there's no sense at all in which we're marginalizing doctrine. On the contrary, you know, the idea would be that you can only mend the rupture of participation through the divine descent, through incarnation and mediation, and that the mediation based on incarnation, that ultimately analogy isn't secure without that. And so I suppose as time has gone on, I've more and more gone in the direction of insisting that we have to think of creation, the Trinity, creation, incarnation, as kind of all one doctrine, really. And this is the sort of radicalizing orthodoxy dimension that has crept into things. But I think also already, and right from the beginning of my trajectory, I was thinking of modernizing participation by insisting that it is a participation in the divine creative act and in the divine trinity, understood as a kind of inner divine creativity, if you like. So, you know, my very first article was about Nicholas of Cusa, and it very much sort of based on that principle. So if I'm now more directly trying to write this metaphysics of creativity, I think that, you know, that has always been there. But radical orthodoxy is a very, very broad church. It's a very diverse movement, you know. So some people within it would probably be more conservatively Thomistic than I am. But you know, they're still attached to what we're doing. I think not everybody within radical orthodoxy shares what I'm talking about as radicalized orthodoxy, this kind of Origen Maximus Erugena kind of thing. So that today I think my thinking is very close to David Bentley Hart's thinking. You know, I've known David for a long time and we've interacted a long time. But there are certainly, I think, some things I've learned from him, but there are kind of very natural convergences.
Yeah, absolutely. How have you seen radical orthodoxy in your own iteration, but also in the iteration of other thinkers kind of associated with the movement? How have you seen it intersecting with kind of the lived theology of faith communities of various kinds of stripes? Would you say it has entered kind of the bloodstream, so to speak, of certain church communities?
Yeah. That's a very important question. I'm not sure that I can fully adequately answer it. I mean, sometimes people feel that it's not adequately rooted in faith communities, whereas I would say I'm sort of proud of the fact that it is an ecumenical movement. You know, that I think that's one of the most distinctive things about it. That, you know, I think it's a broadly Catholic Christian movement. That involves Catholics, Anglo-Catholics, Orthodox, but also, you know, members of the Reformed community, communions, and the evangelical in the sense of Lutheran communions, who have basically, you know, a very Catholic mindset. And I think that, you know, the more I've experienced and read, the more I realize that Anglicanism isn't quite the anomaly people think it is, you know, and that, you know, you can't understand the Reformed and Evangelical churches as just the followers of Calvin and Luther or something like that. That's just not the case, you know. They've involved many different theologies, and people trying to reflect very seriously on the Christian tradition. I mean, look at the, for example, just to mention Schelling again, the degree of Schelling's influence on modern Catholic thought, which people are only now beginning to be fully apprised of, or the way somebody like the Catholic von Baader was already saying, look, the Orthodox have the best Christian legacy. And I think it's incredibly, there's a sense in which for me confessionalism has become very, very uninteresting, you know, and we need as far as possible to practice in intercommunion. But I think I think that, you know, radical orthodoxy allied with other sort of kindred movements has been part of a tendency whereby people are seriously trying to think in holistic Christian terms, and in religious terms about everything, because, you know, by no means does an insistence on the Christian mean there are some sort of necessarily very sharp divisions with other religious traditions. Not at all, even if you think Christianity is the consummation. But I think the sense that you know, there isn't necessarily a respectable secular domination, I think that's got stronger. And I think sort of in general, liberal theology has retreated. But when it comes to the actual churches, I think it's a really, really complicated situation. And I would say that within churches, as opposed to the academy, there's much more survival of liberalism and liberal attitudes. And then alongside that, you've got you know, the phenomenon of charismatic churches and new forms of evangelicalism. Certainly, they've certainly permeated the Anglican Church, where it seemed to be quite doctrinally thin and more about a kind of putting on something that looks like a kind of soft rock concert, you know, rather than worship. Mm-hmm. And often linked to sort of thinly disguised softer versions of a kind of prosperity gospel, I think, if you like. So that you're seeing this sort of merging of a kind of mutated evangelicalism that is a sort of charismatic Jesus cult with modes of liberalism. And that's very strong. And, you know, what I know about England, for example, I couldn't pretend even for a second that radical orthodoxy has as much influence as those sorts of things, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think amongst people sort of resisting that, amongst people who have respect for traditional liturgy, traditional pastoral practice, traditional parish life, traditional links of Christianity with high culture and so on. Amongst that, I think radical orthodoxy has had an effect. I mean, I don't think it's been the only influence. And I, you know, Rowan Williams, for example, who's kind of like the grandparent of radical orthodoxy, has had a very, very big influence. And so it's only one influence amongst many, but I think it exists. And without wanting to exaggerate this, and I see the same thing in France and Italy and in New York, and I would say amongst the younger people who are thinking, there is a return to religion. And it's a return to the kind of approach that radical orthodoxy has tried to recover. And you know, people, Rebecca West famously said the trouble with the left is it dresses to lose, you know, so that you go into any gathering of left-wing people and you can see by the way they dress, they're not going to succeed. But one of the things that strikes me a lot about these kind of younger Christian groups, and this is not stands apart from politics, is it seems to me that they look as if they're going to succeed. They don't look like losers. And I think this is very striking. It's not that they're arrogant, but that they are sort of oddly confident. That's the feeling I get, you know, that maybe when I was a young person, you went into a meeting of Christians and you expected them to look rather sad and drab. The odd thing now is that that is almost the reverse. Even though we're talking about minority, that has almost reversed. So I do think this kind of phenomenology is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, your thinking is often linked with a host of thinkers who are either Roman Catholic or Orthodox, and you yourself are Anglican. Have you ever been sort of tempted to give up being Anglican and to become Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodox? And also, what has kind of kept you from actually crossing the Tiber, as it were?
You know, that's probably, you know, a question that would take me a long time to answer. But if I could say briefly, you know, if I'd stayed, if I'd left England for good, I probably would have stopped being an Anglican. But in living in England, I'm not tempted at present anyway to stop being an Anglican. And I suppose it's because I naturally think of the situation of the Anglican Church as being a little bit like the situation of the Orthodox churches that aren't in communion with Rome, even though it's come about for a different reason. But I think of it as being similarly kind of rooted in the lands and in buildings and the geography, if you like, in a kind of sacral geography to which I'm very attached. And to become a Roman Catholic in England feels strangely Protestant, you know, that you go to sad little chapels, basically, of gathered people. And it's somehow just not very attractive. And I suppose, although I sometimes have problems explaining this to Catholics who tend to think of John Henry Newman and Chesterton as having undergone some massive conversion experience, which I don't think is the case at all, you know, by becoming Catholics. I think it was a much more gradual drift, and I think both of them at core are terribly Anglican in their outlook. And I suppose my feeling is that the struggle of the Oxford movement is a kind of struggle to insist on the Catholicity of the church in England. In other words, there's a continuity of bishops, laying on of hands, to some extent of liturgy and so on. You know, this is the church still that was founded by Augustine. Okay, it's out of Augustine of Canterbury. Okay, it's out of communion with Rome, but it's somehow re-Catholicizing that church is to me something very, very genuine and authentic. So the Anglo-Catholic tradition has been there for pretty much 200 years. It's not kind of artificial. It's not some kind of pretend. Mm-hmm. It's an authentic tradition that has often been, you know, historically, especially when it fused with the kind of more broad church element from F.D. Morris, it's often been, you know, ahead of the game. You know, in some ways, it anticipated things you get in the Nouvelle Theology. The insistence that to be a Christian was to be a member of the church and of the body of Christ is probably something that was said by Anglicans before it was said by de Lubac. Talk of the common good was more prevalent amongst Anglicans before it became prevalent amongst Catholics, you know. And, you know, I'm not going to pretend that the levels of Anglican thinking are as well resourced or as sophisticated as those of Roman Catholics, but I'm not sure that, you know, with some honourable exceptions, I'm not sure how far, you know, the specifically English or British, you know, modern Catholic intellectual tradition has got so much to show for itself, you know. And I find myself much more engaged with French and Italian Catholics, I would say, than with English Catholics. Even, you know, people like Herbert McCabe, well, they're quite interesting, but I don't think they're as interesting as continental thinkers. And I find, you know, typically the continental Catholics are sort of very happy with the idea of Anglicanism. You know, it tends to be more English and American Catholics who find it strange.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I think particularly because there are ways in which Anglicanism is quite like French Catholicism, which has this, you know, Gallican undercurrent, you know, and they're not desperately respectful of the Vatican, you know, they're the eldest daughter of the church, you know, and I think that to my mind, there's something sometimes a bit sort of hysterical about American Catholicism that's not very appealing, because it's not so sort of rooted. You know, I find Italians will sort of say, well, Francis, you know, he's a little bit strange. He's Latin American, you know, but he's the Pope. He'll be, you know, there'll be another Pope too. You know, they just don't get so worked up, it seems to
me. Sure, sure.
They've seen it going on for hundreds of years. Yeah.
yes, that's right. Okay. Yeah. I want to ask you, have there been any sort of eureka insights or just special moments of insight in your own theological journey that have had kind of a significant reconfiguring impact on your thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think it all gets back to sort of, you know, probably my first time in Cambridge and the impact of Rowan Williams in particular. And I think I was always, my theology originally was probably quite sort of liberal and pantheistic, and I couldn't understand where historical revelation quite fitted into that. And then I think reading de Lubac and von Balthasar, I suddenly saw that, you know, nature, there isn't any pure nature without grace, and that there's a certain priority to history because of the arriving gift of nature, of grace. So this is one reason why I'm so resistant to the sort of whole pure nature idea. It would kind of, it would undo my reasons for being an Orthodox Christian if I were to accept pure nature. So I'm very, very hostile to that idea, which I think is just not there in the fathers and isn't really there in Aquinas either. And I think it's sort of as if you're saying that God has laid down some sort of layer of impermeable necessity, and then grace is a sort of icing on top of that cake. So it's too semi-pagan, if you like, to revert to my earlier invective after Schelling and Reverson against this sort of necessitarianism. But so I think that my big eureka moment was when I suddenly saw the absolute primacy of the incarnation and the Trinity and grace, and that you couldn't make sense of anything without them. So, yeah, at that point, I became suddenly one summer an Orthodox Catholic Christian. And it was largely by reading Hans-Georg Gadamer and Hans-Urs von Balthasar that I somehow suddenly saw the primacy of the historical and the hermeneutic, and then I linked that to revelation and grace. I think also because I'd studied history previously and had been very kind of historicist, in a kind of, you know, we must read things in historical context mode, which wasn't wrong. But I think I suddenly, reading Gadamer, I suddenly saw the fluidity of time and the hermeneutic principle that, you know, you can reinterpret the past and so on, that it has this kind of dynamism. And that enabled me then to start mediating between nature and grace, with, if you like, historicity reconceived being the mediating link. So that for me was the really big eureka moment in my it was in my the summer of my first year at seminary, because I was originally going to be ordained but had pursued a lay career instead. But it was in that summer was the big eureka moment. And then after that, I was trying to link up this new way of looking at things with my kind of love of the Renaissance and the 17th century. And it was at that point I saw that Nicholas of Cusa was going to be the link, that he got this traditional way of looking at things, but was trying to integrate a new sense of metamorphosis and creativity and perspective into a traditional outlook. So that was the second eureka moment. I remember sitting in a friend's flat reading, I think, about Nicholas of Cusa, in a history of philosophy. And before actually reading him, I thought, oh, yeah, this is going to be it. So that was the second eureka moment, which, and I'm still kind of building on that. And then I think, okay, the third eureka moment had happened before then when I was at Oxford, and I was doing political thought. And I really thought, look, I don't agree with any of this. I don't agree with Hobbes. I don't agree with Locke. I don't agree with Rousseau. They all assume that conflict is fundamental. Why has nobody apparently noticed this? You know, so that was my sort of reaction against, doing the history of political thought paper at Oxford, despite my kind of indebtedness to the Cambridge School and Skinner and so on, is rooted that was the germ of one strong theme in theology and social theory. And then I suppose sort of reading during the 80s, reading Lyotard, The Postmodern Condition and so on, and then seeing how you could respond to postmodernism with a revived Platonism would have been another moment of insight. But then, apart from that, the more kind of like inspirational eureka moments lay back in childhood, mm-hmm. So when we lived, I was very, very ill as a child. It was nearly fatal. And then we moved to the countryside, to Gloucestershire, partly for the sake of my health. So when we lived in the Cotswolds, I picked up the famous book, Our Island Story, that all British children used to read. And I suddenly realized that there was a real story, that was history. And with a shock, I thought, my God, story is real. and that's why I got interested in history. And then one day my father said to me, that's a totally Platonic hill. It's a perfect hill. So I said, what do you mean? And he explained to me Plato's theories of ideas. And I thought, yeah, that's true. So I became a Platonist at that point. And then it was a question of how does that Platonism relate to history, and so there was already that concern. And then I was obsessed with children's literature and myths, and especially the story of King Arthur, and especially the story of the Holy Grail. And somehow that was the link between Christianity and England. And I was, or Britain rather. And then I was very keen on, Christianity because I'd read St. John's Gospel. So I liked the opening of St. John's Gospel. And I realized that somehow linked with Platonism. So there were those four things. There was John's Logos, the Holy Grail, the story of England, Platonic ideas. They were already there before I was age 10. All those obsessions, including the question of the identity of Britain, which is there in my poetry, but also in the politics of virtue, all those things are still there.
Mm-hmm. Where did Ruskin and Christian socialism come in for you? When did you discover those?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I was brought up a Methodist, a nonconformist, and a liberal, so this won't mean much to you as an American, but we took the Manchester Guardian, which was the nonconformist liberal newspaper, is now the Guardian. But before it was the Guardian, it was the Manchester Guardian. And because it was nonconformist, it didn't have any racing. And before it became, sometime in the 1960s, it started to cover horse racing, and it switched from Puritanism to the Permissive Society. And I think I think had a sort of complicated relationship to the 1960s, you know, that I can't, and how that related to my parents' Puritanism and all that. But I think one upshot was that as a teenager, I stopped being a liberal. So while I was still a Methodist, I stopped being a liberal and became a socialist, which was particularly to my mother's horror, because I think she was Scottish, but had been brought up in this very Scottish Tory Protestant tradition that somehow socialism was a substitute for personal salvation, which to my mind was too close to a sort of being successful in the world. I think my mother eventually grew out of this. But it just didn't seem to me very much like the New Testament. And so, you know, so I became, while still a Methodist, and as I've said, you know, a vague liberal pantheist, I became a socialist. So that preceded being an Anglo-Catholic. But after I'd met my wife, Alison, and Rowan Williams, and I became Anglo-Catholic, my wife had been brought up an Anglo-Catholic Tory. But she more or less said, look, if you become an Anglo-Catholic, I'll become a socialist. So and of course, this kind of Anglo-Catholic socialism is sort of rooted in a kind of radical Toryism to some degree, which, you know, as time has gone on, I've more and more sort of seen that. But I was very excited, because I was already a socialist, I was very excited to discover there was this tradition of high church and Anglo-Catholic socialism, in which, you know, R.H. Tawney, probably the most famous Labour Party thinker, he very much stood in that tradition. And already when we were in Cambridge, I got to know Thaxted, where the famous Red Vicar Conrad Noel lived, who sort of restored the church to its medieval glory, but he was also a communist. And I was very interested in all that. And I suppose it was when we moved to Lancaster, because Ruskin lived on latterly on Coniston Water in Cumbria in the Lake District, to the north, just to the north of Lancaster, and Lancaster had a Ruskin Centre, that I got very interested in Ruskin. And I realised that sort of Ruskin's simultaneous Toryism and socialism was what stood behind a lot of the traditions of the Labour Party. Mm. And I was very, very sort of interested in Ruskin's aesthetics as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was kind of like a natural evolution. And also, I mean, almost by accident, when I was working on my thesis on Vico, largely in the British Museum in London, I got offered this temporary post in Christian social teaching at Lancaster, which was twice renewed. So I landed up being 8 years in Lancaster. And so my job, I was expected to work on Christian social teaching. And so really that's how, you know, that's how theology and social theory came about at the end of that time, more or less. And you know, I might have focused on something else, but you know, as quite often happens in people's lives, you go in one direction because, you know, that's what you're being asked to do.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Turning to theological arena today, what do you see as the most encouraging on the one hand, but also perhaps the most discouraging sort of aspects of the contemporary theological scene?
Well, I think that's fairly easy. I think, you know, the kind of fag end of liberalism that is just gone into sort of baptized wokery and goes on and on about gender and race, or else is kind of barely Christian at all. Just sees everything as some kind of religion, as something we make up, or something so-called miscalled poetics. I mean, I think, you know, all that's a totally dead end. I mean, this is just treading water. You know, it's just careerism. It gets you jobs. It's nobody, you know, the world is not going to pay any attention to that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I think the sort of recidivism, this kind of what you're finding in a lot of Catholic and Orthodox theology, a kind of conservative retrenchment, is also very bad. And if it does have a future, it's only a kind of frightening future. And all too often it gets linked with forces of religious nationalism and quasi-fascism and integralism of the wrong kind and so on. So both, you know, the neo-patristic movement in Orthodoxy and neo-scholasticism within Catholicism, I think, are just terrible mistakes. You know, I understand the reaction against liberalism, but I think there's a complete failure to, you know, deal properly with the scholarship and a sort of retreat back into manualism and into a total ahistoricism about all this sort of thing, and a failure to see that so much neo-scholasticism is in itself very modern and part of what has helped to shape modern theology. So that whereas I think, you know, the creative currents in 20th century thought were indeed the Nouvelle Theology and the sophiological current in Russian thought. Those two things, most of all. A lot of my current work has got to do with sort of a realization that those most crucial currents of 20th century thought are themselves profoundly rooted in Romanticism. That you know, you can track back the Nouvelle Theology to French spiritualism. You know, that it's not that de Lubac and the Lyon Jesuits suddenly discover that there is no pure nature. It's more that somebody like Ravissant has already said, look, grace is part of nature and we can't understand nature without grace. And I think they are in that lineage. And similarly with the sophiologists, obviously they're rooted back to the work of Vladimir Soloviev. But then one sees just how far that Russian stuff is really rooted in German Romanticism. And then one understands how Ravissant, who is rooted in the thought of Maine de Biron, but then Ravissant meets Schelling on more than one occasion. And eventually Ravissant is very influenced by Schelling. And as Ravissant is Bergson's teacher, you can see how there's a lot of Schelling in Bergson. And then to kind of extend that further, I think also the American transcendentalist current from, you know, Emerson and then going into Peirce, there's a German romantic and a Schelling influence there as well. It's a lot of my work at the moment is very Schellingian, or Schelling read in a certain way, shall we say. And it's very anti-Hegel. But then what one also, I think, understands is the degree to which some of these currents are rooted in people that you kind of only nowadays read in weird bookshops. You know, so for example, that Schelling is very influenced by Claude de Saint-Martin, who we think of as a kind of weird Masonic esotericist, you know, but he, Burma is conveyed through him. And so I think part of what's going on at the moment, and this is not just me, we see this with other Christian thinkers, is a rethinking about, you know, so-called Christian esotericism and perennialism and so on, which goes along with the question of the boundaries between Christianity and Hermeticism, Christianity and Gnosticism, and so on. You know, boundaries that somebody like Hans-Urs von Balthasar was always uneasy about, but maybe was not sufficiently prepared to accept that we, you know, that we need to go a bit wilder here. That there are maybe some of these currents are more orthodox than we think, to put it that way. Even if they have to be very much sifted, you know. But just to give an example, I mean, what is the Trinity if not a theosophic doctrine? You know, it's about the internal life of God. It's inherently a theosophy. You know, it's not an accident that Rosmini, you know, is a perfectly orthodox Catholic. His massive big work is called Theosophia. So I think that, you know, that this sort of question about, well, what are the actual bounds of orthodoxy? And that's, you know, closely related to a sort of new realization that the New Testament itself comes from a very Hellenized Judaic world, you know, and from a world that was very eclectic, you know, so very syncretic, you know, that the Christian revelation itself is set within this very interreligious, intercultural world, you know, Helleno, Greco, Roman, but also Persian influences as well. And, you know, in the globalized world we're in at the moment, that has to be, you know, very relevant and bears reflection. And I think that, you know, probably again, there's a kinship with David Bentley Hart here, that some of my current work and an essay I've just written is sort of a question of, you know, how does monotheism actually relate to monism? You know, if creation is from God, what does it mean that reality consists of God and the creation? You know, how, isn't there a sense indeed in which all is one, even if also things are distinguished? And, you know, if, to put it really crudely, we can say that, you know, the Orient has emphasized unity, even if it has recognized persons and individuality, whereas the West has rather a lot more recognized personhood and individuality, then, you know, the question is of the mediation between that two. How, you know, and after all, isn't that the core of Christian doctrine? You know, God is one essence in three persons. Christ is one person in two essences. You know, the question of the relationship of personal hypostasis to unity of essence, and the mediation there being relationality. And, you know, and of course the Russians have always had this sense that they're in the geographical middle, somehow trying to bring together unity and individuality. I think all that is of extreme importance, you know. So that on the one hand, I'm, you know, still insisting, you know, Christianity is the truth. It is the real universal truth. But I'm also, and maybe more than before, saying, well, Christianity is the thinking through of the universal and the perennial that is there. To an important degree, and in important degrees that we learn from in you know, all human cultural formations, you know, from the tribal to the city, to empires, and so on.
Sure. One thing we haven't talked about yet that I think might be of interest to some of our listeners is the relationship between radical orthodoxy and post-liberalism, especially the sort of different post-liberalisms that are on offer.
Absolutely.
In America. Well, totally.
And I'm going to the launch of Patrick Deneen's new book tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
As it happens, by accident. So I'm afraid I haven't read it yet, though. I've read the first one, and I liked the first one. I felt, to be honest, probably, the Adrian and I, in the politics of virtue, were trying to do something more elaborate and also to offer more policy prescriptions, which I think Patrick is now trying to do. But I suppose, to put this very briefly, I felt that in that book, Adrian and I were trying to define post-liberalism very much as a space that was neither liberal nor populist, in a way that could be inhabited either on the political right or the political left, although our personal leanings were more to the left. And I suppose I would say we're dismayed by what we see as kind of an American conservative hijacking of post-liberalism, in a way that to us makes it sound much too close to populism and too close to nationalism. As I say, I haven't read Deneen's book yet. And I understand the idea that nationalism is trying to sort of resist globalized post-liberalism in the name of locality and democracy. But I don't think you can just do that at the nation state level. I think nation states themselves can be very oppressive. They're often mediating globalism anyway. They're often too like individuals writ large. I don't think that we can combat international capitalism in a globalized era save by having different forms of internationalism. And I also think that the kind of political tradition that Adrian and I stand in, a kind of relational personalism, is about mutualism and relationality at every level. So it's also about relationships that cross borders. It's internationalists as well as very local. And, quite honestly, that's the real principle of subsidiarity. It's certainly not about isolated, absolutely sovereign nations. And the doctrine of absolute sovereignty is itself an essentially liberal doctrine. It's a denial of fundamental relationality. It's the idea you need a state over against the people in order to control anarchy. It's basically Hobbesian. And as John Gray said in a recent book, there's something incredibly unrealistic about Hobbes's idea that we're all isolated individuals but self-interested individuals who are then going to submit to this, organizing state, because it becomes more and more apparent that actually that calculation doesn't work, that far too many people calculate they can get away with breaking the law and continuing to act like criminals. So that liberalism is being, very, very severely perverted. So I would want to carry on insisting that post-liberalism is a kind of communitarianism that is very distinct from populism. But I'm very pleased to see that somebody like Sohrab Bahrami has been actually much more saying, look, we can't have strong families and strong marriages in an extreme capitalist individualist order. You know, that if you want marriages to stay together, if you want to have fewer abortions and so on, then you need to do something about housing and making jobs pay. You know, absolutely. You know, that would be my way of thinking. And, you know, a one-sided focus on cultural issues and cultural war issues is a mistake, you know. You know, even if there is a real wokery that I would resist, nonetheless, you know, if the right is just going to play that card, and it will probably do that in England, in Britain quite soon, then that's a dangerous evasion of the fact that, you know, we live in a horribly unequal world. We have a rentier economy. We have the financialization of housing. We have a capitalism that's kind of mutating into a new form of feudalism and keeping everybody in serfdom. And you know, just focusing on these cultural war issues is then a distraction from that. But if we now get a Labour government, as we may well do, that really does nothing about those fundamental socioeconomic issues, and instead, you know, just pursues trans rights and penalises people who say the wrong thing, then they will be playing into the hands of the rights ultimately. And, you know, my big fear is that we will see a dominance of a new kind of fascist right, you know, more and more in the long term. And I think we'll only avoid that if we get a kind of genuinely mutualist, socialist, communitarian left that does something about producing a more just economy and also pursuing a green economy in a way that doesn't penalize the working classes, because there's a danger they will do that as well.
Sure. As we wrap up here, I want to give you a chance to share what's on kind of on the horizon for you. You've mentioned a bit about your new book on metaphysics and creativity. So if you want to say anything more about that, or any other projects that you have sort of in the works, I just want to give you a chance to share what's next for you.
No, I've really probably said enough about that project already, and I'm trying to focus pretty exclusively on that, although there is some possibility that Adrian and I might write a very short sequel to our politics book. Simply because we feel there's such a terrible political vacuum, especially in Britain at the moment.
Okay. Well, I want to say thank you very much, Professor Milbank, for coming on. It's been a joy talking with you. I appreciate your time very much.
Thanks very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.